Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, we are doing my favorite thing, following the big, dirty money. This time, the focus is on the world of private equity. Those two words, private equity, together sound so restrained and elite, even contained. In reality, though, the world of private equity is rough and destructive and affects all of us, from patients seeking healthcare to workers losing their jobs. There's more than $10 trillion in private equity assets under management, and many public pension funds, as well as ordinary members of the public, are invested. It's not private at all. Joining me to discuss this topic are authors Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner. Their new book, These Are the Plunderers: How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America, is a must-read for anyone and everyone who wants to understand why and how the rich get richer and the rest of us are struggling to make ends meet. You may recognize Gretchen and Josh from their first book about the 2008 financial and related mortgage crisis. It was a great resource for me when I wrote about that dangerous time period. The first book is called Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Gretchen is the senior financial reporter for the NBC News Investigative Unit. A former stockbroker, Gretchen won the Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for her trenchant and incisive reporting on Wall Street. Josh is managing director at independent research consultancy Graham Fisher & Company, advising regulators, policymakers, and institutional investors on banking and financial markets. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, guys. So good
Hi.
To see you.
Good to see you.
Great to be here.
And I, before we started recording, Gretchen, I noticed that you look like you're in a hostage video, but you say you're okay. Can you like put, like, if everything's all right, can you make some sort of like, look, oh, there's a coffee cup. She's drinking coffee.
Yeah.
And she's
yep.
smiling. Okay. Okay. I'm going to trust that she's okay. It's just that she's up against a wall, but it's not a white wall. It's kind of like grayish.
No, it's like gray. It's like felt. Anyway, it's soundproof. That's the important thing.
Okay, great. So whatever's going on outside, which may be really fascinating, you can't even tell us about. And Josh, you are like in the Architectural Digest apartment scene with like, I even see an orchid. And I think that's actually no. Those stargazer lilies. Is that what that is?
And they are the inappropriately termed oriental lilies.
I call them stargazers.
I thought stargazers are smaller, but you may be right.
You may be right, but they smell so good, especially if they're on day two
exactly.
or something.
Exactly.
And you've got some artwork around you. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's just artwork.
There people you know, or?
Some of them, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know what you can see, strangely.
I can't tell whether these are photographs or paintings.
So there's photographs over here of Vic Muniz, who I don't know if you know his work.
I know nothing.
Fascinating. His work is all about challenging perception, that we start to look at images that we think we know and stop thinking of them as the thing it was meant to be. So as example, Andy Warhol's images of Liz, we all look at today and we go, oh, that's a Warhol. That's an image of Liz, as opposed to thinking about what Warhol was trying to get at by doing an image of Liz. So he tries to throw blocks, roadblocks in your path, so you have to go back to the a priori.
I feel like that's a metaphor for your approach to investing and writing, is it not?
It is. Challenge the obvious.
Okay. So I guess that brings us right to I don't know what's obvious, but okay, let's take that. If you wrote this book with Gretchen, These Are the Plunderers, and the subtitle is How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America. Let's take this art theory and use it as a frame. What was the obvious part, and what are you challenging? Unbridled free, unfettered capitalism? Is that the obvious? How would you map that onto your project?
Well, so if we map that into the metaphor, and I'll let Gretchen continue with it after, I think there's a general feeling of something is not right. And we all accept that. And that has been a bubbling undercurrent of our social, political, and economic reality now for quite a long time. And we all are playing with this, what is it, without stepping back and looking at, is it actually the underpinnings of what we think is capitalism, but is no longer capitalism? And so we, following that metaphor, it's very easy to accept this is what capitalism is, but what we're practicing, what we wrote about, is actually not what capitalism is.
I couldn't agree more, and I love that. And Gretchen, do you want to pull this thread?
Sure. Well, the other thing, so I'm a financial journalist, and so what I'm always looking for are the hidden elements to any story, the things that people aren't seeing beneath the surface. And private equity is just it's a stealth operation that a lot of people just don't understand, and they do not know how often they interact with private equity companies every day of their lives. They do not know how many hospital emergency departments are run by these financiers. They just don't know the extent to which this is impacting them. And so from the standpoint of really searching out the truth as a financial journalist, this was just a really important goal, I thought, to really helping people to understand what is going on with this practice, how pervasive it is, how pernicious it is, and so that they can be educated.
I love that. That's a public service, but it's also interesting as an investigative journalist. Sometimes hard to have a conversation when we know people who aren't as familiar as we are with the subject. And so I'm going to try to take it, I guess, piece by piece by asking you how has this phenomenon changed? In your book, you describe around 35 years of the development of this, I don't want to call it a sector, and I don't want to call it an investment class, and I don't want to also call it a virus. I'm not sure what to describe private equity as, shadow investment market. I mean, to me, you call them plunderers, but this is a $10 trillion assets under management type of sector, I guess I'm just going to say for loss of a better term. So how did we get here? And why is it so bad? And I'll start with you, Gretchen.
Well, I would call it financial engineering, sort of on steroids. I think sector is too kind because, sector makes you think of an industry, healthcare, or, utilities, or something that actually provides value and a service to people. And this is not that, okay? This provides a lot of enrichment to a very small number of people and a lot of pain to a very large number of people. So I would call this financial engineering kind of on steroids. And, it really started back in the 80s when we were going through a period of kind of resurgence in the stock market. We'd had this terrible, terrible period of the 70s, stagflation, and, valuations of public companies were in the toilet. And so the 80s were a period when things started to revert back to a period where you would want to be a stock market investor. Volcker was, fighting inflation, taking interest rates up. The stock market finally started to take off. And you had this moment in time where you had a huge differentiation between the value that these companies had in the public markets and what their intrinsic real value was.
So you mean the flows, you're saying like if we said there's 1 million shares outstanding and it's trading at $10 a share, the float would be 10 million versus what the actual book value, fire sale value or
book value, enterprise value, whatever you wanted to call it.
Okay.
So So they would arbitrage this, right? They would buy the company, they would lever it up, you know, and then maybe improve some aspects of the company, its performance, and then sell it within a couple of, you know, 5 years. And that was a, there was a genuine alpha to that. There was a genuine return to that.
I'm gonna stop because I know what you mean by lever it up, but can you say, so in other words, they want to buy a company that's already traded in the public. They borrow a lot of money in order to be able to buy it. That's what you mean by leverage, right?
Right.
And then at the time it was a way, you said, to maybe improve the company because maybe it was being mismanaged. You could, in theory, right? The positive side would be.
Right.
Okay.
But then you would take on this big debt. The debt, of course, is a cost. It's a cost of doing business for the company. They also have to pay the debt back. And so that's makes it a little trickier. But because there was such a difference between what the intrinsic value of these companies was and what the market was valuing them at, it was a real opportunity for arbitrage and for making a return.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it started.
And does that morph into, for those of us who remember the 80s and books like, you know, Den of Thieves, and so on? Is that what you're, Josh, you're nodding your head? Can you elaborate?
That's exactly what it is. So this was the, and it was the greatest good, the beginning of the greatest good era.
Gordon Gekko. Wall Street, the first
yuppies.
Movie.
Yeah. Remember Yuppies?
I do.
Right. And so it was exactly that era. But to Gretchen's point, part of the taking on debt was, one, to be able to do the leveraged buyout, to buy out the company, but two, to have working capital to improve the business over time, to generate outsized returns, hopefully, so you can pay down the debt and then refloat it into the public markets to capture your value. Right. That was a, at the time, kind of ugly because there was a lot of job losses. There was a lot of negative social impacts that were going on as a result of it. But there was still a theory of improving a business long term.
And it's funny because, you know, I got out of college in 89. I worked as a paralegal for a year and then I went to law school. And when I was a paralegal, I was working in that year on the I forgot which law, well, I don't want to say the law firm was at, but I think we were representing the bondholders in the KKR takeover for RJR Nabisco. It's something that I know that you write about, but you know, when I went off to law school, I had a really negative impression of leverage buyouts because I thought that they were just designed to enrich the people organizing the buyout and, you know, stripping value. You know, I had a very negative idea because I had worked on something and then I get to law school and then everyone's, you know, when I take my corporations class, you get the other narrative, right? You get the sort of, oh, these, you know, entrenched managers are sitting on their butts all day, playing golf all day, collecting big salaries, leaving a lot of cash on the balance sheet, not getting shareholder value. This is how we discipline them in the marketplace, right? Versus the, and then, oh, Marty Lipton, he's so bad. He's creating these poison pills so we can't take over these firms. So can you, either Josh or Gretchen, because before we move from the 80s to where we are now, can you tell me the competing, I mean, it's almost like gospel, the competing stories and where the truth was at that time, if you think there is a truth between managers aren't really doing their best for employees or shareholders, and that's why these buyouts were helpful, versus that's nonsense, this is just an opportunity for these buyout firms to just, you know, be vultures and prey on people.
I tend to, just to give a simple, I'll let Gretchen hers as well, but I tend to believe in the latter more than
the vulture.
Former.
Yeah, right. Me too. I still haven't changed much.
You know, because if you look at the performance of the companies, the viabilities of the companies, the survivability of the companies, the job losses of the companies, the destruction of corporate brands, I think it's hard to argue otherwise. And so I think we're in agreement there. I think the problem is that relative to where we are today, that's quaint in retrospect.
Okay. Because back then, there's also this connection. You know, you mentioned, Gretchen, you know, Paul Volcker making interest rates go up to sort of tame inflation, but that also kind of, we all know, broke the backs of the savings and loans, who were then also kind of pushed into or enticed into through both deregulation and these buyout firms. Like when these companies were taking these, when these vultures, we can call them, or when these pillagers were taking these companies private and using a lot of debt to do that, it wasn't like their own personal debt that they had to pay. They were issuing debt. And who was buying the bonds? It was the savings and loan managers who didn't know what they were doing. Are they in on the take? Some of them, we can mention, you know, went to prison. Or it was pension funds or whatever. You're always finding the greater fool to dump the debt on, right? I mean, that was happening then.
And insurance companies. Let's not forget about the centerpiece of the story at the end of the junk bond era, which was the failure of Executive Life, which was an enormous California-based life insurer that was run by a fund manager who was very aggressive, had been actually a high-flying fund manager back in the 60s. And he was running this thing and buying a lot of Drexel Burnham Lambert issued debt. And that went awry for him in 1991 when after Drexel's failure and that market sort of went kaput because it no longer had Drexel sort of orchestrating everything would be a word. The market really collapsed. And so Executive Life fails and in walks Leon Black, former Drexel banker, knew where all the bodies were buried in this insurance company portfolio because he had actually done the, you know, issuance and of the debt. And so he comes in and picks these amazing portfolio companies up for pennies on the dollar. And therefore begins Apollo Global Management, which is one of the biggest private equity players in the world.
And it's worth just stepping even one step further back from that.
Okay.
Which is Drexel Burnham really was the epitome of that greed is good ethos, right? It really was an outlier, by the way. It was a renegade firm. It was not well respected by the rest of Wall Street at the beginning. It was viewed as doing, frankly, you know, risky, dangerous, aggressive transactions.
And let's even back up even farther. Okay.
Yeah.
I think everyone knows this, but I did this sometimes at the beginning of like the first day of my securities regulation class, right? Some of the basic stuff. So, you know, Drexel Burnham investment banking firm. What are, in theory, investment banks supposed to do? They're supposed to be helping businesses raise capital. That means money so they can grow the business, make their products better, hire people, et cetera. There's different types of capital, just a way of saying funding. And this gets, you know, I'm not going to be too nuanced. There's equity and there's debt. And, you know, you can issue equity more than one time, but equity is like stocks that people buy and you buy the stock and there's no guarantee you get any kind of dividend. Usually, you know, the best you can do is sell it at a higher price, you hope. And if you buy debt, which is like bonds, for example, in theory, you're guaranteed to get paid back your principal and your interest on time unless the company goes broke. Businesses like, whether it's the Goldman Sachs of the world or Drexel or whoever the investment bank is, they're sort of an intermediary between the company that wants money and people out there in the world who have money on their hands, whether it's you and me, you know, it's Gretchen or Josh or me, or it's someone like the firm I worked for, Fidelity Investments, who's buying it for their mutual fund, or it's an insurance company that needs to invest in something because they're taking in the premiums and they want to make sure if there's an event they have to pay out for, they can sell the stuff they buy, right? Like that's kind of like really simplistic thing. Now, when you say you're talking about Drexel being the worst of the worst, now can we, and Gretchen mentioned, well, they, you know, this Leon Black knew where the bodies were buried because, or maybe it was you, Josh, who said because he had created, helped issue this debt that was then sold into the insurance company. Now you can pick up where you left off, because I just want to show we have all those pieces there.
Well, and remember, there's also a cost difference between equity capital and debt capital.
Perfect. Yes, explain that.
And so debt tends to be less expensive than equity for companies to issue. The junk bond era, the Drexel era, sought to take advantage of that. Historically, only companies that were well-run, high credit-worthy companies had access to the debt markets. They were able to raise capital at, you know, some premium to, you know, treasury rates, LIBOR rates, etc. Drexel said, hold on, maybe what we can do is we can actually get debt funding for companies that are really high risk, that probably have a lower probability or chance of repaying the investment.
And the theory is, you know, just like the portfolio theory, of have a basket of different things. You know, maybe regular, maybe treasury bonds are paying 4%. And maybe, you know, corporate debt from a company you really trust because you don't think it's going to go broke, maybe they'll pay you 5%. But like, what if you can get 15% from a company where like, it's a crapshoot? Some people want to do that. Just like you're saying with equity, you know, some companies are going to go bust. Some are going to go through the roof, and you just try to manage a portfolio. That's the theory. Again, like all these things sound so nice in theory.
And so that was Drexel's game, was they really innovated the selling high risk, high yield debt to insurance companies, to pension funds, to investors writ large.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
So then we're doing an LBO. This is where the LBO comes in. You, me, and Gretchen, we see a company we think is undervalued, right? And we don't have, you know, enough money in our bank. So, and maybe we're managers somewhere. So we would go to our friend at Drexel, and we would say, can you raise $1 billion for us?
That's right.
And we want to buy this company for less than $1 billion, but we need to pay ourselves some stuff and do this and that with it, right? And they would loan it to us, whether or not we're actually... They would loan it to... Go ahead.
They wouldn't loan it to us. That's where the issue is. They would
loan it to us, to an entity.
Right.
The entity we're about... They create a new shell that's going to buy the old company. And the new shell now is in control of the company and has this debt. So every month, before they even bring in a penny and whatever thing they're selling, they've got to make this debt service.
Right. So
and when we their
survivability just went down on day one of us acquiring.
But even if they go into bankruptcy... Who's screwed over? It's the insurance company or whoever, right? That was the sort of way it happened in the 80s, right? In the junk bond era. And we know Michael Milken went to prison for whatever it was, parking or securities fraud or whatever the heck that was. He also got pardoned later by Trump, right? But okay, that's the 80s. We're not in the 80s anymore. It's 2023. What happened between that? How do we get to even on steroids, this technique that we have that we now call private equity instead of junk?
Well, we still had the same people playing the game. They were getting more and more wealthy as they did so. Jen, there are ups and downs in the markets. But these folks figured out a way to continue playing this game where they would buy companies, load the company up with debt, claim to make efficiencies, claim to improve the operation, and then hope to sell it in 5 to 7 years. And along the way, very important change occurred, which was that pension funds began investing with these people. And so you had CalPERS actually investing directly in Apollo. So you had these enablers helping these people raise these funds because they needed performance. The pension funds needed to meet their obligations, and they thought that these funds, these buyout funds, could help them do that.
By the way, you said CalPERS. That's a California public employees retirement fund.
It's the biggest pension fund. It's the one that everyone follows. What CalPERS does, everybody else does. So when CalPERS went headlong into private equity, that meant that everybody else was going to do it as well. But so you had this symbiosis, this symbiotic relationship between the pension funds as the investors and these fund managers, these private equity buyout kings. And that really fueled the success of this type of financial engineering. Without those pension funds, there's no oxygen in the room for these people.
I've been to conferences with, you know, whether it's CalPERS or Lasers from LA or whatever. And all, you know, what is it? What did Tolstoy say? Every well-run pension fund is the same, but every, no, I'm kidding.
Every unhappy pension fund.
But sometimes they have hundreds of people that are consultants. I mean, who can even keep 100 people in a Rolodex, right? And they don't always know what they're investing in, but they're under huge pressure to generate these returns. And then you have some people who are just elected in and out of, I'm not saying that's what CalPERS is, but I think CalPERS also had there's often scandals where it's not literally pay to play like you've talked about, but sometimes there's shady stuff that's happening. So we're talking about big piles of money.
More than that.
Yeah.
And part of the problem here is for a very long time, we had underfunded pension funds, underfunded pension obligations, underfunded corporate pension obligations. We had a long period where the planning for the future retirement of employees was not funded appropriately by corporations. They theoretically were supposed to be funding these plans, they didn't. And then when they would try and play catch up, the returns that they were getting in the equity markets, indexes, stock indexes, public market indexes, weren't keeping up with, or filling the holes, I should say, in what their future obligations to retirees would be. And so that's really when the whole push into illiquid assets, whether that is private equity or commodity fund, et cetera, started to rise. And it came with this belief that, as we talked about, higher risk, higher return. Here's your opportunity to take a portion of your funds and put them in higher risk, but higher reward investments and play for your salvation. And the reality is that they weren't really, and net of fees, performing much better than public equities. But the pension fund managers had the ability to mark them sort of however they wanted or however the funds said, because there is no mark to market on these private transactions. And so you could just keep rolling the loss, but stating that it wasn't there.
It's funny, and I know this is like maybe just like a footnote here, but I don't know if you're talking about underfunded pensions. I don't know if you read Ellen Schultz's book, Retirement Heist, years ago. She worked for the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. I recommend it to you, Josh. Just put it on your list. But so you have this, it's a perfect storm, but it's also different laws change to allow this, right? I mean, pension funds at one time were supposed to be more safely invested, kind of like insurance companies, right? And I don't know if it's more of a supply than a demand side thing. You know, if these people, you know, you have to, it's kind of reminds me of the mortgage market or the toxic mortgage supply chain when interest rates started to go up and there weren't as many mortgages being originated for refis. You got to put something through the pipeline. And I think this is what's happening. Like when you see an opportunity, whether it's the Drexels of the world, like, hey, we learned how to do this engineering. We really know how to issue really risky debt and place it places. So let's keep doing this. And the other side of this that you guys talk about in the book, which is fascinating, is it doesn't matter what happens, they still win. Like you're saying, okay, so look, you get your fees up front for engineering. These managers that you help take over a company, they're happy, they pay you a huge fee. And then when the thing falls apart and no one knows what this stuff is worth, you can go in and cherry pick or buy whatever you want and then make money at the other end. Like, it just feels like it's like, in the more complicated it is, the more likely you are to be the expert making money off this. Is it that simple? I mean,
it is. The problem is, let's relate it back to the real world.
Okay.
Because I think that's where the problem is. And frankly, that was really where the genesis of this came, was during COVID.
Okay. Let's talk about that.
Okay. And, you know, Gretchen and I talk constantly. And one of the things that we were kind of shocked with was how unprepared we were. And that there weren't enough beds and there weren't enough ventilators. And you were hearing problem after problem in the healthcare supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Gretchen said, you know, we really need to start diving into this more deeply. And it wasn't just healthcare. Healthcare actually was sort of the symptom of the end of cycle. And so as Gretchen pointed out, that the early cycle for private equity was going after industries where there was a difference between the value you'd get in the public markets and what the company was intrinsically worth. And then it went to other industries. It went to retail. It went to, you know, a whole host of, you pick it, consumer goods companies. And as there was less and less and less to pick over, private equity started going for things that we've historically looked at as social goods. In other words, companies that aren't, and industries that aren't supposed to necessarily run to maximize profits, because they actually have to have a cushion in them, excess capacity, because there's a social importance, education, healthcare.
So they squeeze the juice out of all these private sector type entities. And then you go to the things that are supposed to be a public good. You're saying education and hospitals, they squeeze the blood out of all of that too.
That's right. That's basically right. So, you know, and that's where Gretchen really, you know, started identifying the hospital emergency room transactions and the games that were being played in a very...
Can you step up? Can you tell that story? Because I think the hospital emergency rooms and the long-term care, it just was like a gut punch to read about this. Because I do follow some of the people that you use as sources, like Rosemary Batt and Eileen Applebaum's work. But like, so there were things that were very new to me that you were writing about, and it just... so deeply corrupt. So start with the emergency room. I think that's good.
Well, so that's a staffing company situation. And private equity saw that if you staffed emergency rooms, you don't have to make an investment in the asset, okay? You can just simply say, all right, go to hospital, whatever name it is, and say, we will run your emergency department for you. And we'll take that off your hands. We'll take the, you know, hiring of the physicians, the clinicians. We'll do all of that for you. We'll do the billing, the administrative stuff for you. Take that off your hands. And soon enough, you find that 40% of the nation's hospital emergency departments are run by private equity because there is money to be made in those operations. And how do they make money? Well, one of the companies, which was called Envision, which was owned by KKR, was really the company responsible for what became known as surprise medical billing. So you go to your emergency department, you're at your most vulnerable, you're ill, you've just been in a car wreck, whatever it is, and you assume your hospital is in your network. In your insurance network, it will pay. The insurance company will pay for your bills. What Envision did was it carved out of network the emergency department so that you would then have to pay that bill over and above what the insurance company paid for your treatment there. And these bills were massive. And people were all sudden saying, wait, what? This hospital is in my network. Oh, well, no, the emergency department is not in your network. And this was such an outrage that actually our dysfunctional Congress had to do something about it. And they, you know, created the No Surprises Act, which did not eliminate the problem, but it curbed the problem. So here's a perfect example of private equity finding a way to gouge patients for their own purposes and for their own ends. And after the No Surprises Law took effect, Envision could not make its business model work, and it filed for bankruptcy. So I think that's a great bookend story to tell, that illustrates kind of the larger picture of what often goes on with private equity.
And it goes deeper than just hospitals as well, right? It goes to physician practice organizations, where they'll take over groups of physician practices. They'll cut the overhead. They'll cut the expense. They'll sell off the real estate into a related fund often. They'll consolidate the costs and essentially put the debt onto the practices so that doctors can't provide the service. They have to take on more and more patients. The practices don't work and they fail. And so that's.
And this was born of a loophole. Well, I don't know if I'm going to call it a loophole, but there are rules around medical practices that you describe.
Corporate practice having, medicine.
So can you describe what the rule is and how these organizations, I think, actually don't just skirt the law, but violate it?
The corporate practice of medicine goes back over 100 years. And the intention was, going back to what we were talking about, social responsibility, that a physician or the physician's first obligation is to the benefit and the health of their patient. And so the monetary recompense should be second to the outcome of the patient's health.
It's almost like a fiduciary duty,
That's
but
right.
more so.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it is. And so it started out of the, the AMA, and it was essentially the belief that corporations shouldn't own medical practices. They should be owned by physicians. And there were laws on the books in, you know, the majority of states to that end for a very, very long time. And there still are in quite a number of states. I think there's in
like around
33, 34. But they ended up figuring out ways to skirt that as well. And so, you know, Gretchen had found in one of the cases that she found, there was a doctor who theoretically had 300 physician practices around the country that he owned.
He was listed as the owner of all these practices, right?
That's right. Which, you know, when you start rolling it up, you realize, no, it's private equity, and they set up a shell, a subsidiary company, where he's the listed owner, but we know that he's actually not the owner, and he's not really running things, and they're not running for patient outcome. And that's...
Well, you say he's not really the owner. I mean, you mean they've basically stripped away the ownership right, that like any control over the decision-making,
yeah, right.
and most of the money,
right.
but he's nominally, like,
that's correct.
Maybe...
That's
yeah.
correct.
Okay.
So he's the paper owner,
that's right.
and
that's right.
essentially, Envision, in this case, is directing the operation of whatever it is, whatever emergency departments that he's supposedly running. And so they have circumvented this prohibition against corporations practicing medicine by installing a doctor who is willing to sell his name and put up a shingle in this sort of fig leaf arrangement.
And by contract, they're getting all the benefits.
That's
and
right.
then, but the problem gets to, I mean, you know, this is what, you know, what you were trying to do earlier, Josh, let's bring in and where you guys started, which is, how does private equity, we talked about the techniques of it and how it sort of it got built, but how does it hurt people? And here is one glaring example, which is when you are having these private equity firms be owners who are rapacious, they've got debt service to cover, and they are in there trying to cut costs. When it comes to emergency departments, you described something in the book where there was a hospital where they only had one emergency doctor across three. There was the emergency department itself, a pediatric emergency department, and that anytime you could have a code blue elsewhere in the hospital, you had one person.
That's right.
How is
right.
that acceptable?
Right. And so that was a lawsuit that it was a wrongful termination. So what happened was the emergency department head, the physician, said, this is wrong. We really have to change this. He got his entire group together and they said, we've got to change it. And they tried and tried and tried and it never got changed. And this was another Envision. This was Envision. And this was where this guy with 300 practices was the paper owner. And so our heroic emergency department physician gets fired because he's making too much noise about patient safety and they want to get rid of him. And so he sues for wrongful dismissal. And that is how we find out that he was actually working for this doctor who was the paper owner, his name is Gregory Byrne, and how he had 300 practices and our heroic emergency room physician had never met him. And so it's such a sham. And yet nobody anywhere, no state attorney general goes after this practice. And it's so obviously a sham. It is so obviously a sham that when another emergency staffing company was public and had to file its risk factors with the SEC, it described this arrangement as potentially a legal liability. And so it's obviously a sham, but no one does anything about it.
And part of the problem is that the name of the companies is not the name of the private equity fund. The name of the physician practice group is not the name of the private equity fund. The name of the large retailer that private equity buys remains the name of the large retailer that private equity buys, or the casino is still the same casino name. And so there's very little one look through. You don't necessarily know who the ultimate owner is, and that becomes a bigger problem when you get down to something small and discreet like a physician practice or a hospital. Mm-hmm. They don't disclose what they own. And then you also have, because of the legal structure, the structures protect the private equity fund, even though it's the ultimate owner, right? So it's very hard to go after the private equity funds legally as well.
It's so on the side of the, before we get do another example, I'm thinking about what would it be a small local hospital? Why? What are the pressures? It can't just be greed on the user side of the people who use private equity. The example that you gave where there's this staffing firm that's owned by a different private equity firm, you know, they're preying, it seems to me, on hospitals that are things that, as you note, don't usually have a big profit margin that are, you know, hospitals have been run by, you know, the Catholic Church, hospitals have been run by religious organizations. They historically haven't been, you know, they're often nonprofits. They have thin margins, you know, and the cost. I'm just trying to understand why you would. Is it just just trying to cut costs in a genuinely caring way that, to stay afloat, that these hospitals do this? Or are these hospital executives sort of in on the game too here? Like, is there a way to run a hospital without outsourcing all this stuff anyway? Is it, you know, is what's going on in terms of the demand for this side?
Yeah, I think that what these the private equity firms capitalize on with their discussions with hospital administrators is this is a headache. It's a headache to run an emergency department. It's a headache to bill. It's a headache to keep track of everything. We will do that for you. We are efficient. We're efficiency, you know, experts, and we know how to do what we need to do, and you can just leave it to us. So there's something very inviting about that, right? You're a hospital administrator. You've got, you know, it's like MASH every day of the week, right? You've got nightmares coming at you from all ends. And here's somebody who says they're going to solve one of your problems for you. And it's going to be easy and you don't have to worry about it.
But what about the bargaining power saying we want to have a minimum? It's sort of like a classroom, which no one, I guess teachers don't have the bargaining power, but like we need to have a certain amount of coverage. They don't negotiate that in the contracts. They don't know to do that.
I have not seen the contracts, Jen. They're very protective of these things. The contracts would show, for instance, if there are arrangements where the private equity firm pays the hospital, you know, any sort of increase in revenues that might be generated.
Yeah. I mean, because it seems to me like there's got to be a reason, there's got to be something going on.
Or
bonuses paid to people signing. But you don't think so, Josh?
I don't. I mean, it's possible. And we're sort of at, you know, but I don't know if you've got people who have an expertise and their expertise is in healthcare, and someone comes in whose expertise is in financial engineering and they explain to you how you're not maximizing what margin you can make. It's sort of like, you know, hiring management consultant, right? Everyone feels good when they hire a management consultant, theoretically, who comes in and tells them how to make their business more efficient. And so
I thought you hire a management consultant so that you can do a layoff. I didn't know you do it too.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm
That's
stupid.
Exactly. The okay. same. That's the point.
I didn't mean to be cruel in my laughter. I'm laughing because of its gallows humor.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
So let's move on to another healthcare example, and before we talk about like how we can fix this problem. I forgot the name of the billing at the, I guess, the nursing home or long-term care facility. There's this like
Manor Care.
It reminds me of Rick Scott stuff, but yeah. Can you talk about that too? Again, how it hurts people.
Such a great example. Well, so first of all, there was a tremendous study out of NYU, UPenn, and University of Chicago in, I think, 2021. Very good longitudinal study about mortality rates at nursing homes. And the mortality rates at nursing homes owned by private equity were 10% higher than at nursing homes run by anybody else. So even for other for-profit companies, okay? So again, therefore you had 20,000 extra lives lost over the period of the study because private equity trimmed nursing staff. They cut so that they could make more money for themselves. And that often translated to staffing reductions that made the business obviously not run properly for the patients. So that's a perfect, really, really damning.
But in the way they it's so interesting because they found, you know, your description early or about early private equity or junk bonds, who was the taker? It's the public pension funds. Like who's feeding the beast? And here it's Medicare, Medicaid, right? In other words, you've got a government funding of something. And so they're figuring out how to game that system. So they're acting like they're doing all these services for people so they can bill, but they're not using the money they're bringing in to hire staff to turn people so they don't get bed sores and do the actual work to help people. It's really like, it's just totally.
That is an important point that you just hit on in terms of the game is to game every system. So whether it is gaming the pension, gaining the public-private market valuation difference, gaming Medicare, Medicaid, right? So there was another, they took over one of the largest aluminum smelters in the country, in one of the poorest counties in the country, and essentially bought it out with very little equity, huge amount of debt. Within 6 months, they had special dividended themselves all of their original investment. So at that point, they were playing with the house's money and had, 2,500 employees who had been multi-generational employees in this county's aluminum smelter. Then they realized that they actually had an opportunity to try and get even more profit out of it by going to the utility board and saying to the utility board, we're going to file for bankruptcy if you don't give us a cut in the utility rates. And they fought really hard for that. And the utility board said no. And then the private equity firm went to public officials, elected officials, and gave them a lot of pressure. So they then weighed in and pressed the utility board. The utility board finally said, okay, we'll shift some of the burden to our other utility payees and we'll give you a discount. And they still bankrupted it, you know, 9-12 months later, leaving 2,500 or so employees who had been there, as I said, for multiple generations, out of work in one of the poorest counties in the country, leaving the school system in that country with a loss of a third of its tax budget, and walked away. No accountability.
How do we stop this? Oh, before I ask that question, that's a harder question. What are the name brands that people would recognize of companies that were taken over by private equity, stripped of their resources, and went through a bankruptcy? I mean,
well, I think Toys R Us, people really know that one.
Yes.
Linens and things. There were a tremendous number of retailing
companies. Essentially, every major retailer that you've seen go bankrupt went that way.
What would your response be to, well, they were preying on, not that it makes it better, but, you know, everything is converting over into the digital space. And so they're preying on a weak industry. That doesn't mean you should, like, circle around a corpse or anything. But, like, were they going after these before, during, or after the digital revolution? And how does that change your analysis? I'm just curious.
They were going after these well before the online thing happened. And again, you often see that private equity firms look for industries, entities, companies that have underlying assets, real assets, like real estate. Okay, so
right, okay.
In the case of the ManorCare nursing home, what happened with Carlyle, they were able to get back their entire investment in a very short amount of time because they sold the underlying real estate under all of the nursing homes and were able to benefit from that. Of course, the company then had rents to pay that it had not had to pay before, and it immediately became cash flow negative. And so that was a real burden and ultimately bankrupted ManorCare. So retailing often bought because they had stores, they had real estate that could be liquefied and monetized. Another name, Samsonite, is a really good example of a company that was kind of wrecked by these people. You have fast food companies, you know, that you don't think about. Dunkin' Donuts, for instance.
I was surprised because that's my go-to, Gretchen.
Right.
And I did not know it was owned by that private equity firm. I'm forgetting the name of it.
Roark Capital.
Roark, yeah.
And they're trying to buy Subway at the moment. So, but a lot of it is very, very hard to find. I mean, I'm an investigative reporter and it really is difficult for me to identify which emergency departments are run by private equity, which nursing homes, which dermatology companies, et cetera, are owned by private equity.
Yeah, I mean, and pick your local newspaper that you used to know, right? Same thing,
mm-hmm.
Right? It's sort of a think about what's disappeared through bankruptcy, and you've sort of identified where the private equity world has been.
How do we, well, I mean, I don't know how you rewind the clock. We can't do that. But going forward, what should we do now?
So there, I think we didn't even get to where our Gretchen and our and my concern is, which is the
book. Oh, go do that
the
then.
Book,
go
the
ahead.
Book ends, unfortunately, at the beginning, right? Which is the book starts with executive life, the failure of an insurance company that became loaded up with junk debt that was issued by Drexel Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, over the past 5 or 6 years, we've seen most of the private equity funds either buy in whole or in part the large private equity firms, insurance companies. And so they're now buying these insurance companies as a way of A, having cheap funding for their deals, and as a way to then buy corporate pension obligations, switch them over to annuity obligations, and then roll the dice for the solvency of those.
And by the way, the annuity obligations would be issued by these insurance companies.
Correct.
Right. Or backed by. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, to me, that's the scary part, is we can talk about the disaster to corporate America, but we haven't even touched on the future systemic risk here in the insurance world.
Well, we saw this. This sounds like AIG Financial Products 2.0, yeah. which I don't have to tell you all that Drexel people went over to London. And that's the, for folks who maybe forgot about the 2008 financial crisis, all the risk of those toxic mortgage-linked securities was, not all of it, but a lot of it, was linked up with this so-called credit insurance, these credit default swaps issued by... What?
And the transformers offshore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And so that's, I don't love that, because you're right. A systemic risk problem means bailout. Because if insurance, right, insurance companies can't stop, you know, can't stop covering losses, or if policyholders run, it's just like a bank run, as you've noted. So that's not great. So who are you telling this, and how do we stop it?
It's really tough, Jen, because first of all, insurance is regulated by each individual state.
Right.
And so you don't have an overarching federal regulator. Not that they, you know, do a great job either. Okay.
Right.
But, you know, at least if you had a federal regulator, you would have it all sort of going through one thing. Here you have, you know, a polyglot situation with states, and some of them are very lax and some of them are less lax. But in any case, so you have that as a hurdle to getting anything, you know, meaningful done to protect the policyholders in these cases. You now also have the additional problem and risk of many of these companies are offshore insurers.
Yes.
And so
Bermuda, has anyone heard of it?
For the arbitrage of the different capital ratios, for the arbitrage of the ability to keep the funds offshore and protect them in case of failures.
Yeah.
And good luck getting your money out of that, because, you know, you're going to Bermuda to try to knock on the door there and, you know, forget about it. So you have, you know, you have Apollo buying up, now called Athene, buying up Lockheed pension obligations, Bristol Myers, Coors. I mean, the people, the number of retirees of these venerable companies who are relying on Apollo to do the right thing with their insurance and their future obligations is frightening.
And at the federal level, there's some concern, you know, first of all, you saw some concern early on with some of the folks at the PBGC, who the public, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp, who recognized the risk of moving these from government-insured programs, so a corporate pension, defined benefit pension program, if it went bankrupt, there was some insurance that, yeah, there may be a haircut, but there was something there for the retirees.
Right, but defined contributions, 403B, 401K, nope.
Now
right.
There is not. And so that's one of the problems. And at the federal level, you know, Sherrod Brown actually raised a lot of noise about this. He's actually been on this drumbeat. I haven't heard it recently, but he definitely has tried to shine a light and shine focus. But there's very little that's been done or seems to be likely to be done. And so that is, to me, the bigger concern. And yes, we could talk about there isn't transparency in the ownership of what retailers, what healthcare companies, what you pick it, private equity owns. And the pension managers get paid on NAV, so they're perfectly happy.
Net asset value. Yes.
They're perfectly happy to like play extend and pretend on the value, the mark to market, or mark to model, I should say. But the problem to me is this larger problem, and we're not addressing any of the problems at all.
I have an idea, and I've run this by Josh, and you kind of alluded to it a minute ago. I think we should make private equity identify all of their ownership by, you know, their names. Okay, so the Apollo Hospital, the Blackstone Slaughterhouse Cleaning Company that hires children.
Into that one, because that's
the Carlisle nursing home company. So you know what you're doing, you know what you're getting.
That's a great idea.
And you know that these are people who are, you know, extremely aggressive and probably don't care that much about the customer.
And two things. One, when you're talking about insurance, you must know, I hope you know, Dan Schwartz, University of Minnesota law professor who's like the insurance guy. The other thing, speaking of transparency, the Big Five, is it the ones that you mentioned? Carlyle, KKR, who else am I thinking? Leon Black,
Apollo
and Blackstone. Yeah. So Carlyle, I mean, look behind that name is a revolving door of people from Washington, right? I mean,
not just Washington, British government, right? You've had governments around the world.
So, you know, I like this idea of transparency. Is there, but of course, that probably won't happen anytime soon. But you're still, I mean, you still wrote this book and you're raising public awareness. I love, by the way, I think this book is really accessible, I should say, to the public, not just because you're excellent writers, but you have this great photo section in the middle. Like, who gets to write a finance book and have these pictures of people? I mean, I think that alone people should consider. It's very accessible.
Well, you know what, Jen? The reason that I thought, and Josh agrees, this was so important to do is because, okay, I'm a financial reporter, and shame on my colleagues out in the financial world for simply lionizing these people and never really talking to the people who are on the other side of the transaction, okay?
Right.
You always hear about the deal makers. Aren't they brilliant? Aren't they smart? Aren't they famous? Aren't they rich? But you do not hear about what Josh talked about, the school children in New Madrid, Missouri, who had no books because Apollo wanted to get richer. You don't ever talk about the people who lose their jobs. You don't talk about the pensioners who lose their pensions. And so you have this disconnect between, you have this celebration of the deal makers and you have silence when it comes to the actual people who are impacted the most, including taxpayers, by the way,
right,
when the pension fails. And there's silence where those people, and so we really want to focus and heighten the interest in the people on the other side of the trade.
And by the way, that's important also, you know, Jamie Dimon made a comment the other day, 2 days ago, I guess, about how America is addicted to debt and it's very dangerous and it's
he should talk. I mean, it's unbelievable,
right? And that was my first
issued by him, right?
That was my first response. But the other side of it is banks do have leverage ratios beyond which they're not allowed to exceed, and here you've got an industry that doesn't. It is in many ways a shadow banking system.
Absolutely.
Right? And yet we've done nothing to rein it in, to regulate it, nor has Jamie Dimon, who gets a lot of business from these same companies that we're talking about, pointed fingers where it should be pointed, as opposed to it being this generic America's addicted to debt. We should be looking a little bit more about how it's corporate America who in many ways is addicted to the debt. And the big banks, in some ways, are the dealers, right? But the ones who are feeding the addictions are these private equity firms.
So, okay. So now I guess I can borrow, we started with art. So you've brought me to a place where I have to borrow a metaphor from recovery. And the first step in recovery is admitting that you have a problem. You all, sober-minded people, know someone else has a problem. How do we get the rest of us to admit it? I mean, what is the other thing that a man has a hard time of seeing the, is it, who I forgot who had said this. I've heard it repeated many times, but if your paycheck depends upon believing something, you're not going to seek out the truth. So all of this together, you write this book, you hope it's a bestseller. People are reading it. They respect you. They hear this message. What's our honestly a next step? I mean, haven't there been congressional hearings before? And yet,
no,
because you could change the no.
Really oh, there's not oh. Si- not since the SNL crisis, frankly, in a meaningful way, not since that era. And I don't know that that would change it. I think that what really Gretchen and I talk about and have talked about since the beginning, the goal really has to be that people have to start asking where their pension money is invested. People have to start asking what they're buying, who owns the companies that they're going to and frequenting every day. When you go to the doctor, you have to find out whether your doctor is really part of a small practice that they own, or if there's something else behind it pulling the strings, which may be detrimental to your health outcomes. And
it's funny. Imagine going to the doctor like I do, and I'll say something like, oh, you're planning this procedure. What can you tell me what it's going to cost? They have no idea. They won't, and I just do it out of this. You can't even find out what, even if it's your insurance is going to pay for it. I'm curious. They won't even be able to tell you the whole
thing. But
can I just say this one thing, that but it's all very detached. This isn't capitalism, in other words, is what I'm saying. There's a lot of disconnects here. Sorry, Josh.
No, I was going to say, but I don't even know the question for your doctor is, how much is the procedure going to cost? But you should want to know whether your doctor is making the decision because some profit motive that he hasn't disclosed to you is standing behind him, rather than it being for health judgment.
And making him do that, right? I mean, you know, I think most doctors go into the field to help people. But if they've got some overlord standing behind them with a whip, saying, okay, you've got to spend, now you can only spend 10 minutes with the patient you used to spend 15, but that's too much. And let's, have a nurse practitioner see them instead of a doctor, because that's cheaper. And or do more procedures because we can generate more revenue that way. Those are the issues that you don't know are possibly happening. Asking your doctor, are you owned by private equity? I do it now all the time.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's when you greet people from now on. And maybe I should ask you, Gretchen, are you owned by private equity?
I am not. But hey, guess what? Our publisher is.
You went there. You went there.
Yikes.
Yeah,
and
Simon & Schuster was just bought by KKR.
Oh my goodness, because the deal with my publisher, Random House, fell through.
Right.
And I think my publisher, I'm Viking Random House, what am I, Penguin Random House, whatever, it's Viking Penguin Random House, but I think we're owned by some German company that's like a quasi-charity owned by a family. I tried to look it up at some point, and I worried it might be a tax dodge, and I'm writing a book on taxes, and I thought, should I go there? I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. So guys, this has been so good, and we should probably like do this over drinks and go into more depth here, but before we close this, what didn't I ask you that you wanted to talk about? Josh, you first, and then Gretchen.
Unfortunately, I think one of your focuses is on securities, and the SEC has done a really good job of routinely giving waivers to these companies in every single part of this transaction, this business. And that's a problem. The other is all of the executive regulators, frankly, have missed the ball here. There's issues that the FTC should be looking at that they really haven't been aggressive on. The consolidation and monopolization of industries, which private equity is responsible for, has been...
And Lena Khan is starting to step up a little.
She's starting to, but they've still maintained thresholds of, and it gets very complex, how much of a concentration within a market there has to be for...
Yes, I used to work directly. Merger stuff.
And so when you're talking about a small industry locally, right, there's a lot of concentration limits that can be met without triggering anything for them.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's the small actions of the SEC. It's the small actions of regulators that aren't being taken. And there is a lot of opportunity. There's an opportunity, by the way, to start designating aspects of these businesses under the FSOC. Or at least doing real reports and real studies.
As a non-bank, systemically important financial institution, is anything... I thought they took everything off that list.
They did, but then they just put out new guidance as to how they're looking at designation only a month ago.
Thank you. I missed that guidance. Well, there you go. Thanks.
And so I think there are opportunities, but there isn't the public pressure to force those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
To be
good point. And Gretchen, what didn't you talk about?
Well, I think, Jen, the one positive, there's sort of ray of light in the clouds here, is that the market, the rising interest rates are really having a bad effect on this business model. They are showing this business model to be unsustainable, okay? This is a business model that requires zero interest rates and everybody looking the other way, okay? And now you've got high interest rates. These are companies that issue floating rate debts, so they have had their costs go up dramatically. And so the business model is being shown to be unsustainable. You will see bankruptcies. You saw the bankruptcy of Envision. You've seen other bankruptcies of private equity-backed companies. It is becoming evident, I think, because of interest rates, that this is an unsustainable business model. And I think that's a great silver lining in the cloud here that I hope has an impact and I hope can help augment what we've done with the book and demonstrate to people why this is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. I love talking about impending financial disasters. That's the place I know the best. So thank you. Anyway, thank you both for joining me. Congratulations on the second collaboration with this excellent book.
Thank you, Jen. Really great being with you. And just thank you so much for highlighting it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to continuing the conversations.
It was really great catching up with Gretchen and Josh. I think I may have met Gretchen once in person many years ago, but I mostly just know them from their prolific writing, whether it has been historically in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or their commentary on news programs. I trust their research implicitly, and I find their approach to be incredibly engaging. It's hard, though, I will admit, to get to the end of the conversation, highlighting one of the biggest flaws in our current, I don't want to say, sort of intersection between financial and corporate systems in the country, to see this thing and to see the unfairness and to see maybe an impending disaster down the road involving private equities take over insurance, and to hear this and to sort of be nodding my head and go, well, okay, now what can we do? And the answer kind of being, well, maybe there's not much, feels bad. And, you know, I guess people who invest think, well, I guess, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, or maybe find a way to bet against the collapse. That's what people have done historically. Can't we do better? We must do better. And so I'm just hoping that this little podcast here that you listen to helps raise the awareness and gets us paying attention, and maybe doing what, you know, what Gretchen said, like ask your doctor. Find out about the restaurant you go to. Are they owned and controlled by private equity in a way that could harm you as a consumer of, you know, of medical services, or hurt the workers, you know, but are there choices, you know? So, you know, I guess the first start is transparency and awareness. Next step is seeking to stop this predatory, dangerous, systemically risky behavior. It's that old, you know, privatize the profits, socialize the losses concern that we have. We can do better. But we can only do better here if we know what's going on, and we can work together to try to change things to make the financial system, the business structures, and our society much more fair for all of us. So thank you for listening, and I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please continue to let us know what you think. I really love getting your email at bookedup@politicon.com. And you can also write me at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.